How are you?
What's up, man?
Hey, the pilot number 39.
I didn't think we ever get this far.
Well, we get one step closer to our promised 100.
Yeah, we're getting close. Yeah.
Well, this is a very special show. It's a very special show for me, and I think for you as well.
Yes.
We pride ourselves on being Angelenos. We went to school near downtown LA. We went to school in one of the oldest Catholic high schools in LA. So LA history is very important to us, right? And
Thanks to Mr. Jimenez.
Mr. Jimenez, yep. Yeah. And Dr. James, right?
Dr. James, yep.
We get a lot of information on old LA through books and through stories. And it being a very special treat, we have Jeff Asher here with us. Or actually, we're here with him because we're in his place out here. And Jeff is a very incredible man. There's a movie I like called... what's it called? The Secondhand Lions. And have you seen that movie?
Yeah,
it's about a kid who goes and spends time with his grandfather. And, you know, there's all these tales that they do all these incredible things throughout their life. And you don't know if it's true or not. And every time he finds these little clues. And I think there's a little bit in that with Jeff, with how much he's accomplished in his life. Jeff, how are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Well, Jeff, to tell the public a little bit, to kind of introduce you, you've spent a lot of time in Los Angeles. You've done a lot of work here and in very different industries, and you've seen LA transform. How were you born in Los Angeles, or where were you born?
Yeah, I was born in Los Angeles. I was born and raised here. But the idea of my giving you a chronological story in which you can certainly interrupt me, to either elaborate or stop, my chronology would begin probably before I was born, if you have any desire to know about my mother and father. And as I mentioned to you guys, I would like to have this recording serve a dual purpose, not only for whatever use you guys might have, but I would like it for my kids and my grandkids and my great-grandkids to actually, if they ever were interested to know what their old father, grandfather, or great-grandfather did, this is the one opportunity to give it from the beginning to the end. Not completely filled in, of course, because that 91 years is a long time to try and fill in one session. So if you don't mind, I will start in 1924, or a little before then. I was born in Los Angeles, September 6, 1924. I was born on the east side of LA, where my folks lived at the time. I was born in if anybody knows the hospitals here, in what was then called the Casper Cohen Hospital. Later became the Cedars of Lebanon, but it moved from the east side, and the east side is still tough. At the time, it was a combination of Jewish and Latino area, almost 100%, the two. I don't know exactly what makes it up now. I think it's more Latino than Jewish now, although it is. It's still sort of a combo. Anyway, I was born in 1924. We lived there. Within a couple of years, we moved from there to West Hollywood, which at the time was in the county and is now a separate community. I think my father would roll over in his grave if he knew what the nature of the community was now in West Hollywood. But in any event, we were out in the sticks. West Hollywood was, you know, 16 miles from downtown, and that was a long way. So that's where I was raised from the time I was about 1 1/2. My brother was born in 1926, and we lived there on Florey Street, just above Santa Monica Boulevard, in what is now West Hollywood. And it was called West Hollywood then, but it was in the county. It's now a separate municipality.
And you mentioned that it was the sticks, so not a lot of...
There were very few houses on our street other than ours. There were a lot of vacant lots, as you see all over. Of course, all throughout Los Angeles, both the Valley and Los Angeles proper, the population was a lot different than it is now. It was a relatively small community. It was only after the war, which of course ended in 1945, that people really started coming out here in droves because of the knowledge of the weather and many other things. And the big developments, both in the Valley and in the LA area, were post-war. And I say post-World War II. So if I can follow my original notion of giving you background, my mother had been an actress, a leading lady on the stage. She was born and raised in New York City and was part of a traveling group that would come out and travel all over the country as they did with performances. And she was in San Francisco for a couple of years between her age of 18 and 21 or 22, where she played at the Belasco and at the Alcazar. People may remember it, but they probably don't remember. Her name was Emily Pinter, P-I-N-T-E-R. Her father and mother would travel with her, sort of as chaperones. And we're talking now about the late 19-teens and the early 1920s. And they were, my grandfather was from Hungary. He was born in Arad, which is a little community. I'm going a little far-fetched now, you guys, but I'm giving the kids a background. Arad was a city in eastern Hungary, part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and it is now a part of Romania. It happens to be in the same area where Dracula's castle is, which is interesting. So if anybody is a buff of Dracula, you can look that up. Or if you happen to ask someone on the internet for technical assistance and they're from Romania, ask them about Arad and Dracula's castle, and they'll tell you in a perfect English accent. Anyway, my grandfather was Hungarian. My grandmother, who would travel with them, was her family were from Northern Ireland and Germany. They were with my mother when she was in San Francisco in the late teens and the early 20s, and where my mother met my father, who was from San Francisco. And his family were basically Polish. So anyway, they got married in 1923. I believe early on, they moved from San Francisco because of disputes with their parents. I mean, it doesn't matter what generation you're in, you have parental problems. And they moved to Los Angeles, the small community of Los Angeles. And I was born in 24, and my brother was born in 26. Okay, now I've given you as much as maybe you need or want in the 20s, although the 20s were definitely roaring 20s. But I, as a little kid, don't remember the roaring part of it.
Causing the roaring.
Yeah, pardon me?
You were causing the roaring.
No, I was not definitely causing the roaring. It was wilder than the post-war era here. The roaring 20s were like the gay 90s in the 1800s. We won't go back to that. But I remember as a little boy of 6 years old, the great crash in the market, the stock market, which was in 29. Incredible. And of course, people in this or even the previous generation to me do not have any knowledge, direct knowledge about it. People were jumping off of roofs. They'd lost everything. They had margined themselves. And my grandfather was one of them. So that my grandfather, who lived near to us in West Hollywood, he actually lived on the edge of what is now Beverly Hills. He had a heart attack and died in 1930. My little brother and I, who were 4 and 6 at the time, really remember, because those events were striking for little kids. And my folks took in my grandmother, which was my mother's mother, because she had nothing and had no place to go. So I grew up not only with the influence of my parents, but the influence of my maternal grandmother, and which I can tell you is incredible. One of the highlights of my life is the remembrance, and my brother and I, every time we have lunch, we would remember our grandmother. So anyway, and her name was Emma May Moore Pinter. So now we begin my life on Florey Street, and I went to the local schools, as did my brother. We went to Laurel Grammar School, which is nearby, and maybe some people listening to this may know Laurel. I think it's still there. We went to junior high school at Bancroft Junior High, which is on Las Palmas, just below Santa Monica Boulevard, in Hollywood. And then in high school, half of the kids from my junior high school went to Fairfax, and half went to Hollywood. I went to Hollywood High and spent 3 years there at Hollywood. I can give you anecdotes about both the junior high school and the high school, but I'm not sure that that would be terribly interesting, except that in December of 1941, December 7th to be particular, as any historical buff will remember, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. I was a senior in high school at the time. The bombing took place on a Sunday morning, to be exact. An incredible other experience, a cataclysmic experience similar to the crash in the stock market. And of course, I've skipped over the Great Depression. The Great Depression took place in the 30s, from 1930 right through until the beginning of the hostilities in Europe. The only reason that the United States got out of the Depression, and despite what your political bent may be, the only reason was because of gearing up for war. The so-called New Deal of FDR's in the 30s did not do it. We were in a hideous depression all during the 30s, and you were fortunate if your father had a job. My father fortunately had a job. He happened to have been working in the motion picture industry, and he had a job offer from some of the people involved in the industry who were in the retail distribution, that is the movie exhibitors. And so Dad was the lend-lease man in real estate who would select the theater locations all during the late 20s. And then in the early 30s, the people who owned West Coast theaters, which were the exhibitors that my father worked for, bought Ocean Park, which is the amusement park there just below Santa Monica in the city of Ocean Park. So Dad had a good job during the 30s. He was the general manager of Ocean Park Pier Amusement Corporation. So you can imagine, as little kids, we were really lucky. Of course, amusement for a nickel or for a dime, you could ride the roller coaster and do all kinds of things. You could go to the plunge, you'd go to the movies and everything, go bowling. So we were very lucky. So that brings us up to the point where a moment ago I was describing December 7th of 1941, where as a senior in high school, and my brother was 2 years behind me, I can remember going into the auditorium at Hollywood High, and in our class, I'll give you another little bypass, in our class were many Japanese. Because the Japanese during the 30s, it was a worldwide depression, had migrated to Southern California, a lot of them. So from grammar school on, many of my classmates were Japanese. Usually in my classes, they were a year or two older because they couldn't speak English when they came here, and it took them a year or so to learn the English language. But every Japanese person that was my friend, that I knew, was in the top 5% of the class. I mean, the level of intellect and intelligence, even though they were poor, was incredible. The art skills were incredible. So I had great respect for the Japanese. And because my last name is Asher, they would seat us alphabetically. And on that morning of December the 8th, when we came into the auditorium, seated next to me was my friend Kyoko Araki. And her little brother was also seated next to my brother, because his name was Asher. And I can remember vividly the incredible consternation of the Japanese student body. And maybe there were 15% of our student body were Japanese. And as you know the story, and I will not go into details of reciting it, shortly after the bombing, all of those Japanese were put in camps. There weren't concentration camps, as people call them, but they were detention camps. And they were deprived of being able to go to college. Here are these people all at the top of their class were in various camps on the West Coast. It was a dilemma because the Japanese in Honolulu, and which are there's very large Oriental population, both Japanese and Chinese, the Japanese, many of them, helped guide in the bombers from the Japanese aircraft carriers. So the United States didn't know who to trust, and so they put them all away. And great criticism, but I don't know what else you could have done. Anyway, stemming from December the 7th as a senior at Hollywood High, 100% of my class enlisted.
Wow.
And we were in the class to graduate in February. They graduated, all of us. And everybody enlisted in the service, whether it was in the Army, the Marines, or the Navy. I was only 17, so I said, oh, geez, the world be over, you know, by the time I'm 18. You know, I want to go to UCLA. So I entered UCLA in February of 1948, and I joined the Naval Unit, the Naval ROTC. So I enlisted also, but I was, you know, there I was, safe and sound, I thought, at UCLA. So I was able to get 2 years of college in, from February of 1942 to February of 44, in the Naval Unit. But I majored in naval science. And I got my commission in January of 1944. My brother also was in the Naval ROTC, but he was still at UCLA. My brother was a big football star at UCLA. And during the time that I was at UCLA, or at least early in the game, we had some very notable people. Kenny Washington, Jackie Robinson, Woodrow Wilson Strode. If you guys follow early football, they were football players. Jackie Robinson, I knew, played baseball too, but didn't realize that he was to become the first black man to break the barrier later on. But they were in classes a couple of years ahead of me.
Was he more recognized on campus as a football player than any other sport?
Oh, absolutely. But he was an incredible athlete. But he was also an incredible baseball player, too. But at the time that I was at UCLA, we had never beaten USC in football. And I think that that Kenny Washington and Jackie Robinson and Woody Strode were on the first team that beat USC. At least we tied them 0-0. And the same thing in basketball. I played basketball, not very well, but I made my letter. So I played basketball at UCLA during those 2 years. But I got my commission in January of 1944, and I got shipped out. Here I am, I'm 19 years old now, almost going to 19 and a half. And I got shipped out to, instead of the ship that I wanted to be on destroyers, and I was entitled to because my ranking in class was such. But I was in they shipped me to the amphibious forces. So I had gotten into trouble with the captain of the unit. I will not recite that story, although if you want to go back, I can tell it to you. I have no qualms about it. And he said to me, he said, "Asher, I'm going to really take care of you. You're going to be in the amphibious forces."
What is the amphibious forces?
Amphibious forces were ships like LSTs, LCIs, LSMs, LCTs that carried personnel into the beaches on the first day of the landings, and then carried supplies back and forth. And they were not really seagoing ships. They were flat-bottom boats because they had to go up on shore, and they'd open their bow doors and let the poor devils out, push them out to make the invasion of wherever you're invading. In effect, the captain did me a great privilege. Here at 19, I became one of the key officers on a ship. I was on LSM 28. We were shipped back to Little Creek, Virginia. If anyone in the Navy knows, they've been to Little Creek. It's just outside of Norfolk. And it's at that time, and I think still, where the amphibious forces train. At the time of the training, when I arrived there, there were a lot of other people from NROTCs, but they were all dum-dums. They were all people who were at the bottom of their class, because it's like, you get stuck, in the amphibious forces, and they don't want to put you into a regular. So I was very fortunate. I was able to actually get a spot promotion from ensign to JG, and I got assigned to a ship, and although I was at first a gunnery officer, communications officer, supply officer, of LSM 28, I became the navigator and executive officer. By the time we got down, we shook down in Houston in June of 1944, and then we went to the Panama Canal to go across to make the invasion in the Philippines, which was scheduled for September of 1944. Nobody knew that's what we were going to do, but that was. But by the time we got to Coca-Cola in Panama City, which is only about 14 or 15 days. And by the way, the flank speed on an LSM is 14 knots, and it's seldom made flank speed. It's a ship which has a flat bottom, a 6-foot draft, 36-foot beam, 202-foot length, two bow doors, one 40-millimeter cannon, and four 20-millimeter cannons. So it was a ship, but not very seagoing. It was a big bathtub, and we carried five medium tanks, all the poor devils who were the personnel involved in them. And usually we would go in to make the landings the fourth or fifth hour and push off the medium tanks for them. We had a crew on the LSM. The naval crew was four officers and 50 enlisted men, and usually about the same number of officers and enlisted men in Marines or the Army units that we carried. But back again to the story, by the time we got to Panama City, our orders, and after we'd gotten there, our orders were changed because half the crew was not physically capable of running the ship. They all, almost all, had gonorrhea as a result of being in Houston, Texas, for the shakedown. Luckily, those of us who were able-bodied, and we took the ship up to San Diego and escaped the immediate going overseas. Well, while in San Diego, here I am, 19 years old, and I'd been engaged for a couple of years to my high school sweetheart. I called Mary and said, I'm going to be here a couple of weeks, let's get married. And so I got married, she's Robin's grandmother, of course, the mother of all my children. I got married September 1, 1944, by a Navy chaplain here in Long Beach, of all things.
Wow.
At the time, my recollection was I thought we got married in San Pedro. But I obviously wasn't paying much attention because when I looked at the marriage certificate and I wanted to go back and see the chapel here just a couple of weeks ago on the 1st of September, by George, it was Long Beach. September 1, 1944, we were each 19 years old. We got married, and about 8 days later, I shipped off overseas. My ship left. We had been taken from San Diego up to Newport because we were a small enough ship that they could fit us in there. And we went to Honolulu, to Pearl, and then we went to Midway, and then we went to Guam. And then we made the initial landings in late September at Lady Gulf in the Philippines. It was the first time the MacArthur's forces returned, you know, the I shall return deal. And it was incredible. I mean, for a young kid, now 20 years old, I will not describe it. I would rather not. But we saw a lot of action. We went into Tacloban is the name of the place that the landing took place. Whenever I talk to someone who is a technical expert from the Philippines, I mentioned that I've been to the Philippines, by the way, but it was a long time ago, and none of them were born at that time. I haven't bumped into anybody from that era. But from there, we evacuated troops from the west side, or sort of northwest side of Leyte, a place called Ormoc. And as I say, an LSM, which is stands for Landing Ship Medium, was one size smaller than LST, which is a landing ship tank that they refer to. Or no, landing ship, whatever it is. I'm not sure what the T designation, because the LST was a single little ship. That's an LCT. The LST was a landing ship something. Beats me, but it was 323 feet long, whereas we were at 202 foot long. But the draft was very shallow. So believe me, when you go across the Pacific on a ship that has a flat bottom, it's even worse than a destroyer where you rock and roll. This, you just hit the waves. And I made several trips back and forth in the course of the war across the Pacific. But following the initial landings there in the Philippines at Leyte, our task force was assigned to prepare for the larger landing. And I'm giving you guys maybe more war story than you want. So please stop me if you don't want to hear all this. The larger landing, which was to be to take Manila. And actually, we didn't go directly into Manila. We went north of Manila. But in order to stage for that, they shipped us down to New Guinea. I don't know whether you've ever been in New Guinea, but it's not a good place to go to, even now. And there was a Dutch New Guinea and a British New Guinea. We were in Dutch New Guinea in a place called Hollandia. We took on the poor devils who had tanks that were going to go in for the Manila We staged and did all of our practice landings and things during that period in November and December of 1944, and went as a flotilla. At the time, we were a big, big flotilla, although it was not as big as the Normandy invasion, but it was huge. And we went up through Leyte Gulf, and we went up through the Gulf, and we went by Manila. And we went north of Manila, around into an area called Lingayen Gulf. And if you're a Filipino, you'd certainly know that. It used to be a resort area. And Lingayen Gulf was where we made our landings. We landed on January, I believe, the 8th of 1945. And we got ashore. The little city, and if someone is Filipino, they'll know Dagupan is the name of the city. We were the first U.S. forces into Dagupan. Dropped our cargo off. And then went out in the bay to pick up stuff. That evening, either that evening or the next evening, January the 9th it was, there were huge air raids all during the time of going and such. And on January 9th, I got wounded. I remember it very well, and will not describe it in detail, but the guy next to me lost his leg. And I looked down, I said, "My God, I'm bleeding." And then the next thought I had, outside of taking my packet of stuff, the sulfur drugs that you're supposed to take, I said, "Thank God they're going to send me home." Well, I thought that would happen. The next day, indeed, they brought us all over to the hospital ship. And I got on the hospital ship, and it was just an incredible mess. There were so many wounded people, the doctor said to me, he said, "Sonny," he said, "I'll take the stuff out of your hand," which is where the major thing, he said, "but," he said, "you'll never use your hand again." He said, "but I can't do anything else," he said, "I'm so busy." I said, "Thanks, Doc. I had wanted to go home, but I'll go back to the ship." So I went back to the ship. So on January the 11th, I went back to the damn ship. I got a Purple Heart for my trouble, but I was still there in the combat zone. What we did after that, we staged again after we, and I couldn't use my right hand for a long time, although I used a ball to squeeze so that it was really helpful. And I still have the shrapnel in the hand. I have difficulty going through an MRI because, you know, the metal wants to get out. But in any event, I was able to use my, I was ambidextrous. I've been a basketball player. So I used my left hand. Also, you know, although I did navigate, I enjoyed the navigation. So I still was able to do that. But we staged again for another invasion that was to take place, which was to be the biggest invasion, bigger than Normandy. It was Okinawa. So I did not escape Okinawa. Our task force, we went north from the Philippine Islands somewheres in April. It was about the time that the war was ending in Europe. As far as you could look to the horizon, there were ships. I mean, it was an incredible sight for a young kid, or for anybody. What was this? This is now 45. It was late April. We made, I believe, the landings on May 1st at Okinawa. Our ship was assigned to make the southernmost landing. We surprised the Japanese. They thought we were going to come in on the east side of Okinawa. We came in on the west side, which was unlikely because it was filled with coral reefs, incredible coral bottoms. It was not sandy beaches. In going in, I did not get along well with my captain. I was second in command. I was executive officer, but I did not get along well with him. And in going in, he insisted that he take the con to bring the ship in. And when you bring a landing craft in, whether it's an LST or whether it's an LSM, you drop your stern anchor as you're going in so that you can get pulled off. You pull yourself off eventually. Well, he got so excited, he forgot to give the command to drop the anchor. And we went in, and we went in too fast. We went high and dry on the beach, and we scraped the coral. So we opened a huge hole in our bottom. And there we were on the southernmost beach, the closest to Naha, on the first day at Okinawa. And we were loaded. Well, that was the second. The first time we got our things off, this was the second pass. We were loaded at that time with drums of diesel oil, which is not anything you want to have on the beach, because there were kamikazes coming in, there were people coming in strafing and everything. But we were on the beach for 7 days in an exposed position, which was very disturbing there at Okinawa, to say the least. And we had a hole in our bottom. Anyway, I won't give you the broad detail, the detailed details. We were eventually pulled off. We had shored up the holes, and we were brought to an area called Karamareto, which was a repair base mostly for capital ships, for destroyers and DEs that had been hit, or other ships. And we were just a dinky craft, so nobody really particularly cared about us. But there we were in Karamareto, which is a series of islands about 40 miles west of Okinawa. Eventually, we got an LST to tow us back to Guam, which is several days, believe me. And we got into Guam. Now it's got to be June of 1945. As you'll recall, the war was not over with Japan, not for a couple more months. And we had no idea that they were going to drop a bomb to save our lives, which is what they did. But in Guam, we also didn't get any attention because there were a lot of ships that needed repair. And I went ashore and I bribed the guy who was in charge of the port with a bottle of whiskey. We had one bottle of whiskey. You're not supposed to have whiskey on board, but we did. I gave him a bottle of whiskey, and he says, "Don't worry, buddy. We'll see that you get a tow back to Pearl Harbor." So we got a tow back to Pearl Harbor. And they towed us all the way to Pearl Harbor. And that was a miserable thing, because if you're on a flat-bottom boat, you know, I will not describe it, but the ship split lots of seams during that. But we got successfully to Pearl Harbor. Now it's got to be...
How long was that trip from Guam to Pearl Harbor?
Oh, it was probably 2 weeks, 3 weeks, wow, maybe. Anyway, at Pearl Harbor, same thing. Everybody too busy. You know, capital ships were being repaired. So they continued to tow us. We got towed back to San Diego. We got all the way to San Diego. And in San Diego, here I was again, San Diego. I called up Mary. We had been married, you know, how many months before? 8 or 9 months before. I said, "Honey, I'm here." You know, and so she came down. And our first daughter was conceived there in San Diego in a bachelor officer's quarters at the repair base in San Diego. But since the war hadn't ended, the orders were to repair all of these crazy ships. Our ship got re-outfitted. Now we had twin 40-millimeter cannons. Now we had twin 20-millimeter cannons. We had, why they did it, they repaired every bit of the hull. And we had orders to go over to join our flotilla, to join the invasion, which we thought would be in Japan. And this was now July. It was late July, and we were to ship out of San Francisco. So Mary, by then we knew that she was pregnant. So she went up to San Francisco. I didn't know how long we were going to be in San Francisco to go to the Naval Hospital there. And as it turns out, they wouldn't change our orders. They didn't do anything other than load us with a load of sea mules. I don't know whether you know what sea mules are. They're craft that are harbor craft that carry things in the harbor here and there. And we were to go to Guam to unload these sea mules and then join our group. Well, on August the 15th, 1945, the war ended. We were in San Francisco with orders to go to Guam. And I went everywhere to try and get our orders changed. Nobody would listen to me. Everybody was celebrating. They were throwing people through plate glass windows to celebrate in San Francisco. People were drunk everywhere. You couldn't find anybody in the naval unit to be able to ask. So on August the 16th, the day after the war ended, we sailed out of the Golden Gate with our load of sea mules for Guam. I've really gone into more detail than I should have.
No, you guys, that's fine.
Yeah, I haven't even gotten to my regular
that's
life.
That's all right.
but we went to Pearl Harbor, of course, first. And the captain, who was not my friend, quite the opposite, said, look, said, all of us have got enough points to get off. All of us want to go home. He says, but you're stuck. You got to stay because I'm getting off and there's nobody else capable of being in command of the ship. So he got off and all of a sudden I was captain of the ship and stuck. I had to take those poor devils who didn't get off. And I led a flotilla of LCIs and LSMs to Midway and then to Guam. Back west across the Pacific after the war was over in August, and it took us into September. But thank heavens we found out by that time that we weren't going to have to make the landings in Japan. I'm sure we would have been killed, or the odds are greatly in favor, and I'm sure there would have been millions of Japanese and U.S. killed. Even though everybody talks about this terrible thing of dropping the atomic bomb, it saved huge numbers of lives. By doing it. Anyway, in Guam, now I had to get rid of the sea mules so that I could go home. And nobody cared. They didn't want sea mules. The things were a mess. They were still celebrating the fact they were. So I found the same guy that I had bribed before to give the bottle of whiskey to. And he says, I remember you, Asher. He said, I'll get a crane and take care of it. So they took a crane and unloaded the sea mules and sunk them in the harbor, in Apra Harbor. Anyway, and then we went home. I got home. I know I got to Pearl Harbor on New Year's Day because my brother was playing for UCLA in the Rose Bowl on New Year's Day, 1946. So I listened to the game. And then 2 weeks later or so, I got home and kissed the ship goodbye and named some poor guy who was not qualified, whether he was or not, he got it. I went back to UCLA to try and finish my schooling.
The power of a bottle of whiskey.
You said it. Power of a bottle of whiskey and the power of rank. I mean, it's incredible. And of course, a lot of young people abused it. Something awful.
Yeah.
And thank God for gonorrhea, right?
Yeah. And that was a pretty good bit of luck. So now I've gotten up to the point where I'm 21 and a half. I've got a pregnant wife. I've gotten out of the Navy, and I've entered my senior quarter at UCLA.
But before we move forward, I wanted to ask if you can tell us a little bit more about what you saw or the feelings you felt when the bomb when they had dropped the bomb, or when you heard that they dropped the bomb, did you hear about it through people on a newspaper, through communication within the service?
Oh, everybody heard about it through the newspaper. I don't remember whether there were any official naval communications, but of course it was a great boon. It ended the war. For us, it was fantastic. There were no recriminations as to questions, should you have dropped the bomb? Well, of course you're going to drop the bomb. We're trying to kill our enemy. You know, you kill them one way or the other. It used to be thousands of years ago, you killed them with a sledgehammer or a lance or a knife or something. And these so-called modern people kill them different ways, but they still kill them.
Yeah.
It's a terrible, inhumane thing. There is no excuse for war, I think. But nevertheless, to answer your question, it was a great boon for those. Because, believe me, my high school class, because I mentioned to you guys, I would say 40% of them are dead or died on Normandy. Or in the Battle of the Bulge. A fair percentage of my naval class were killed or wounded. So believe me, I was very happy that they dropped the bomb.
Was the bomb something that you knew you guys had? Like the whole everyone, or was it a surprise?
No, everybody knew that both sides were working on some weapons.
Some nuclear
weapons. I don't know whether we really knew it was nuclear or not. It didn't matter to me as far as what right. they were working on. But in retrospect, as we know now, so were the Germans working on. And believe me, the war would have been different if the Germans had not lost those scientists who defected to the United States or to the Allies. They would have won the war.
Now, there's a story behind that as well, right?
There's a whole story. I don't have that story well. But, you know, anybody historical with respect to the machinations of the Nazi and the errors that Hitler made that made him fouled up. I mean, why he attacked Russia is an incredible arrogance and stupidity. His generals didn't want him to. But that's a whole other thing, you guys.
Yeah.
And some of those German scientists came over to the United States and helped?
They came both to Britain and the United States. Many of them were Jewish, so many of them came to the United States. They were the ones who really were on the project that discovered it.
So you ended your Navy...
I went on terminal leave.
Oh, you went on terminal leave?
In February of 1946. I stayed in the reserve for a while. Why, I don't know.
That's what you knew?
But I sort of had a notion that, because, you know, I was proud of the fact that I had been in the Navy and that we had seen a lot of action. So I stayed in the reserve for 3-4 years. I can't remember when it was. But I was a full lieutenant when I got out. Anyway.
So you're back.
So now you're I'm back. I'm back, and in February of 1946, as I say, with a pregnant wife, I've got a half a semester to finish. I was very fortunate. In the 2 years of my schooling at UCLA, I finished 3.5 years of work.
Wow.
I took a lot of units. So I only had a half a year to go. So I graduated in June of 1946, 1 month after Susie was born. My first daughter, Susan, was born May the 12th, 1946, at midterms while I was at UCLA. And then my career as far as business goes is from that point on.
And take us, so when you were in high school and even as a Bruin, what are the things that people did for fun? What did you guys, drive-ins, or what did people do for entertainment at that time?
I'm sure they did the same thing that they do now.
What's that?
Well, you know. And it doesn't matter what the venue is, you know, or where or how or where the circumstances are. I think people have been the same for thousands of years.
Did you ever take advantage of, like, the amusement park that you're
oh, yeah. That you're as a matter of fact, that was...
For dates or anything like that?
Oh, of course.
Okay, great.
We went, and you know, I I was popular because we had passes. But believe me, during the Depression, which is in the 30s that we're talking about, during that era, the cost of the amusement park was like a nickel or a dime for a ride. It was not expensive. So it was one of the few things that flourished during the Depression. Amusement that was inexpensive flourished during the Depression. Movie theaters flourished. I can't remember how much movies were. They were like 20 cents or something like that. You know, candy bars. I can remember getting loads of candy for a penny. I mean, there were, or for a nickel, you'd get huge amounts of stuff. Wow. It's a different, and that's a whole different aspect of things.